This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 1.3 million people are displaced in the Kasai region of the Democratic Republic of Congo, as thousands of people continue to flee escalating violence and human rights abuses.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva. We'll have the full story coming up. Also, the FAO warns the drought and food insecurity crises in East Africa are worsening, and conflict and insecurity in parts of Mali are now spilling over into Burkina Faso and Niger. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the drought and food insecurity crises in East Africa have gone from bad to worse. In an alert released today, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization says rains have failed for three consecutive seasons going back to October of last year. Besides the widespread loss of crops, livestock herds have been decimated. Milk production has plummeted, adding to food insecurity. The UN agency says rangeland and livestock conditions are expected to deteriorate further, at least until October, when the next rainy season is due. FAO economist Alessandro Costantino explains which areas have been hardest hit.
The areas affected by the current drought are most of Somalia, most of Kenya, northern Tanzania, southeastern Ethiopia, southwestern and northern Uganda. The current phenomenon encompasses an area of about 1 million square kilometers, which is roughly twice the size of France. Also, most of these areas are experiencing their third consecutive failed rainy season.
The FAO official says families in the region are simply running out of ways to cope.
About 16 million people are estimated to be food insecure in this country. And food insecurity actually increased by one third in the last 6 months. In Somalia alone, which is the worst affected country, the food insecure caseload actually tripled in the last 12 months.
Besides the damage done to crops by drought, Costantino says the fall armyworm has spread from southern to East Africa.
The armyworm infestation has actually affected most of the cropping areas in these five countries. It's too early to ascertain and to precisely estimate the impact on current harvests, because harvests are currently being gathered. But for sure, this impact will compound the impact of the drought on crop yields.
While the full extent of the fall armyworm invasion is still being assessed, it's known the caterpillars have affected about 200,000 hectares of crops in Kenya and about half of Uganda's 111 districts. The FAO says cereal prices, which were at record levels in May, continue to surge upward. The Food and Agriculture Organization is responding with cash for work programs, distribution of seeds, feed and water, livestock treatment and vaccinations, and rebuilding of infrastructure. The agency has appealed for $200 million for its operations in Somalia, Kenya, and Ethiopia. It's received about half of that so far. The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 1.3 million people are displaced in the Kasai region of the DRC as thousands of people continue to flee escalating violence and human rights abuses. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says it is alarmed at the soaring displacements and mounting atrocities against civilians as the conflict in Kasai spirals to new heights of savagery. Just 10 months ago, the killing of a tribal chief by members of the Congolese police and army triggered a series of revenge attacks and counterattacks between the chief's Kamuina Insapu militia and government security forces. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler says the conflict has expanded, with other armed groups forming and committing severe human rights abuses against civilians. He says people who have managed to flee are telling stories of terror.
Many of them said that they had spent weeks fleeing through the dense forest without food, drinking water, medicine, or clothes, and saw people dying on the way, including women and children. Other vulnerable cases include civilians wounded or mutilated with machete and gunshot wounds.
Spindler says many people are deeply traumatized by their experiences, but are unable to receive any psychological or social support to help them. He tells VOA the UNHCR is worried about the growing risk of sexual and gender-based violence.
So far, we have very few documented cases in Kasai, but we think that unfortunately that's just because we have not yet reached the victims, or they have not come forward. So we are kind of bracing ourselves for many more instances of this, given, you know, the past experience in that region.
Last month, the UN Human Rights Council adopted a resolution to establish an international investigation into alleged gross violations and abuses in the Kasai region. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news around the continent, a top UN official warns that conflict and insecurity in parts of Mali are now spilling over into Burkina Faso and Niger. He says Boko Haram militants continue to worsen the humanitarian crisis in the Lake Chad Basin. Mohamed Ibn Chambas, the UN envoy for West Africa and the Sahel, says multiple factors are driving migration and human trafficking. He told the UN Security Council these include terrorism, violent extremism, humanitarian crises, and climate change. Chambas says the problems are hindering recent progress made in the region.
West Africa and the Sahel have recently witnessed positive progress in democratic consolidation. However, the security situation remains of great concern. Traditional and new drivers of conflict and insecurity are hampering the capacity of countries to improve life conditions and strengthen human security. Clashes between farmers and herders are another threat. If not contained, they have the potential to undermine peace and stability in the region. The impact of the instability in northern Mali on Burkina Faso and Mali, and the persistent Boko Haram attacks in the Lake Chad Basin area are causing huge suffering to the populations. Up to 5.2 million people, many of whom have been displaced across the Lake Chad Basin area, are struggling for their subsistence.
The UN envoy says it's vital to tackle security threats in West Africa and the Sahel, but he also says it's important for the international community to help nations build the foundations for democracy and sustainable and inclusive development. Coming up on 14 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. While the Trump administration's travel ban no longer includes grandparents, a federal judge in Hawaii has revised the controversial policy affecting mostly Muslim nations. Judge Derek Watson has ruled that grandparents and some other relatives should be exempt. The ruling greatly expands the list of those who have family relationships with American citizens that can affect visa applicants wanting to enter the United States. Judge Watson says common sense dictates that close family members be defined to include grandparents. It's the latest setback to the administration's travel ban that will go before the U.S. Supreme Court in October. In migrant news, more than 103,000 migrants and refugees have entered Europe by sea through July 12th of this year. That's the latest figure from the International Organization for Migration. More than 86,000 of them have gone to Italy, followed by Greece, Spain, and Cyprus. The IOM says, however, well over 2,300 people have died trying to make the journey. The latest arrival figures don't include more than 1,400 migrants who arrived in Italy today. Another 3,000 who were rescued on the Mediterranean this week are on the way. Italy wants other EU nations to take in more migrants, but that proposal has received a lukewarm reception. Well, for about a decade, scientists have been investigating a class of pesticides as one of the culprits behind the worldwide loss of domesticated honeybees. A pair of new studies have people on both sides claiming victory. Ben Thompson reports.
Neonicotinoids, or neonics as they're known, were developed in the 1980s and 90s and became one of the most widely used insecticides. Recently, there has been concern about its effect on honeybees. Roughly one-third of the world's crops benefit from pollinators like honeybees. Studies in the lab have shown inconsistent effects. Amro Zayed, a biologist at York University in Toronto, says that could be because bees aren't being exposed to the same levels of neonics across studies.
People criticize these experimental studies by saying that the authors used too much neonicotinoids or they treated bees to neonicotinoids for a much longer period of time that would be found in the field.
Zayed tried to deal with that question in the first of two studies published in the journal Science. It focused on how much of the pesticide bees were exposed to in the fields. In Canada, neonics are coated onto corn and soy seeds and spread throughout the plant as it grows. The bees pick it up in the pollen. The researchers studied six sites near cornfields.
We tracked them for the whole season and we were able to monitor the neonicotinoids coming into the colony.
The researchers found that the bees brought in pollen tainted with neonics beyond the growing season for as long as 4 months, much longer than they'd expected. They also examined the pollen to determine which plants it was collected from.
And what we found was a big surprise. There was actually almost no pollen coming from corn and soy.
This means that the pesticide was being washed away from cornfields to be absorbed by other plants. Zayed warns these neonics will probably stay in the environment for several years. The researchers then exposed bees in the lab to the same level of neonics found in the field. That shortened the lifespan of worker bees by 25%. In the second study, researchers from the Center for Ecology and Hydrology in England monitored hives at 33 different fields across the United Kingdom, Germany, and Hungary in one of the largest such studies. They found that the neonics generally hurt colony health in the UK and Hungary, but in Germany, the neonics had some positive impact on the bees. For example, the count of egg and larval cells was elevated in Germany, reduced in Hungary, and unaffected in the UK. Researchers point to the local environment to explain the difference. Germany had more flowers by the field, perhaps providing the bees with a better food source. This complexity could explain why some studies have shown negative effects and others no effects or even positive ones. The study was funded by two neonic producers, Syngenta and Bayer Crop Science. They also manufactured the neonics used in the study. Syngenta scientist Peter Campbell noted that the vast majority of the variables in the study appeared to be unaffected by the neonics. He said that the beneficial findings cast doubt on the results.
I do struggle to rationalize a positive beneficial effect of an insecticide on honeybees. And so therefore my next worry is that a real positive effect? And if the positive effects aren't real, I then worry about the negative effect.
Campbell said that the alternatives to neonics are far less effective. There is still no consensus on what role neonics play in bee death, nor what impact ending their use would have on agriculture. Ben Thompson, VOA News, Washington.
Environmentalists have long touted solar energy as a way to curb the carbon emissions that contribute to global warming. However, widespread adoption of alternative energy has been slow in the West. America's electrical grid continues to run mostly on fossil fuels. However, in Africa, solar energy is on the rise in a big way. To learn more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with journalist and environmentalist Ian McKibben, the founder of 350.org, a global grassroots climate change campaign.
Africa may be the most interesting place right now in the rollout of renewable energy around the planet. If you go to rural Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, places that have been, for all intents and purposes, bypassed by the fossil fuel revolution that created the West over the last 200 years, they're now leapfrogging straight past coal and gas and oil and taking their power directly from the sun. Place after place, people are now installing solar panels on their own roof or small microgrid arrays to power entire villages. And for the first time, people have access to electric light, television, refrigeration, all the things that the West has taken for granted for so long. And the genius of it is that they're doing it at a price for people that's in many cases no greater than or sometimes even less than the amount they were already spending for a single kerosene lamp in the smoky living room.
Is it possible that solar will enable people to go directly to solar in a way that is analogous to the way cell phones have gotten rid of the need for a cumbersome telephone, copper
yes.
wire system?
The World Bank, in a report in May, estimated that at the current rate of expansion of the grid in Africa, there'd still be 500 million people without power in 2040. That is, there is a grid in much of Africa. It's usually confined to the cities, and it's expanding very, very slowly. These new technologies allow one to leap over that. So you can put a solar panel on your roof, and the only wire that you need is the one that runs from that panel on the roof to the light in your bedroom. Now, you can't as yet produce as much power enough perhaps to run a refrigerator or a freezer or machines for businesses off that solar power, although increasingly that becomes more possible as panels get cheaper, you just add more of them.
What about the everyday person, though, who has very, very little money? I mean, is this something that a village cooperates to build, or is it a consumer-by-consumer basis?
There's two models. Villages, sometimes people come together to build what's called a microgrid, and they'll put 50 or 60 solar panels in a field at the edge of the village and then run just enough wires to connect the huts in the village. Or more commonly, it's a consumer-by-consumer thing, and people take the money that they used to be spending on kerosene and instead spend it usually through mobile money on their cell phone to pay for one of these solar panels. And after 2, 3, 4 years, they've paid off the system and it belongs to them. So those are the two main models that are spreading in Africa.
Can you tell me why this is great news in terms of development?
Well, it's inspiring to go around to these communities and see places where children are able to study at night. Very difficult to do via flashlight. It's powerful to be in clinics where they were trying to deliver babies by flashlight or kerosene lamp, and now they have access to electricity. Not only that, they have a refrigerator so they can store vaccines.
Can you just tell me, in a nutshell, how this might relate to climate change?
What's happening in Africa is people are developing power without having to build the coal-fired power plants or things that they otherwise would have. And so there's a lot of carbon emissions that will be avoided. Maybe more to the point, some of the lessons that we're learning in Africa about how to do this kind of house-by-house renewable energy will allow us to do the same sort of things in the West, where, of course, we're poisoning the planet's climate on a daily basis with our emissions. So hopefully there'll be some backwash to the overdeveloped world from the developing world.
You sound encouraged.
I'm often quite pessimistic about our future. Climate change is a very pressing problem. But I must say it was very heartening to be in Africa and see how quickly this new technology is spreading. If we have a hope, that's where it lies.
That was journalist and environmentalist Ian McKibben, founder of 350.org, a global grassroots climate change campaign. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips via Skype from Vermont. In Zimbabwe, businesses are appealing to the government to lift its immediate ban on food containers made of the plastic foam, expanded polystyrene, or EPS. The government says the goal is to fight litter and protect the environment. Sebastian Mofu reports for VOA from Harare.
Zimbabwe's Environmental Management Agency has ordered the food industry to stop using containers made of expanded polystyrene and replace them with recyclable or biodegradable ones. The agency recommends restaurants use paper packaging or encourage patrons to sit down and partake of their food on site. The EPA's ban went into effect immediately, upsetting business owners left with unused stocks.
I think this is quite unfair.
Denford Mutashu is the president of the Confederation of Zimbabwe Retailers.
We will comply, but we would prefer that it becomes gradual because we need a period where it has to be phased out.
Steady Kangata, the spokesman of the Environmental Management Agency, says this new regulation dates back to 2012 and businesses were made aware.
We have made wide consultations already. The instrument that we have activated is a staging instrument of 2012. So the time lag between the activation and the promulgation or the gazetting of the regulation, they had promised that they would come up with something tangible, but up to now, nothing has come to fruition, so there's no going back. What they should be doing is looking at alternatives, because alternatives are there, and there are so many and diverse.
EPS is a plastic foam also known as Kaolite. The government says EPS is dangerous as it emits toxic chemicals when the containers are burned, and garbage is routinely banned in Zimbabwe. Another issue is litter. The containers are among the garbage clogging drainage in Zimbabwe and contributing to flooding. Environmentalists in Zimbabwe are applauding the ban, but say the government hasn't gone nearly far enough. Other African countries, including most recently Kenya, have banned the use of plastic bags. Christopher Magadza is a professor of environmental studies at the University of Zimbabwe.
Plastics, when they get into the environment, especially in the food chain, they are dangerous to animals. And the things, you know, people saying some plastics are biodegradable. There is no biodegradable plastic. It just breaks up in smaller and smaller bits. And then when plastic gets fired, and then we breathe it and spoils the air.
The government says anyone found flouting the EPS ban will be fined between $30 and $5,000. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it. VOA.
2-hour audience on VOA's FM in Accra, Ghana. We'll be off the air for 3 days of July 20th, 21st, and 22nd to do necessary technical repairs. We will resume our broadcast on July 23rd. However, you can still listen to VOA's radio programming on our shortwaves, 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also online at voanews.com. Your friends at VOA regret the temporary loss of our FM broadcast on those days.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.